You're listening to Safety Corner, powered by TCL and S1, for workers, by workers. Online and in-person health and safety programs and training available in 10-plus languages. Reach out to them at www.mys1.ca and DM them at my_S1 for more information.
Bon dia, Manny.
What's going on, Phil?
Christmas holidays are done. 2025 is here.
It's a new year. 2025.
2025, man.
Can't believe it's 2025.
We're getting old, Manny.
Some of us are. It's a mindset, man.
My birthday's this month, man.
Is it?
Yeah.
I think every Portuguese guy I know is a Sag. Or what? Is that still Sag or what's
Aquarius,
the next one?
Actually.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. Whatever.
What are we talking about today, Phil?
Well, today we have a special guest on the show.
Someone who's been here before.
Definitely been here before. And always, we always appreciate having him on the show and his insight and his opinions. Well,
knowledge.
A ton of knowledge. Let's introduce Mr. John Savoia.
What's going on, John?
Morning. Morning, fellas. How you guys doing? Happy holidays. Merry Christmas.
Happy
New Year coming up.
Time, hey, did you have your double espresso this morning?
What is it? 8 o'clock. I'm on coffee number 3 by now.
Wow.
Espresso number 3 or coffee?
Coffee number 3. Espresso's around.
How many are you doing lunch a day?
Oh, man, I have way too much coffee.
But coffee's good. I saw that recently.
Yeah, it's. I think everything in moderation, but I have way too many coffees. Like, it started at the ministry. Because when I was in construction, you wake up, you have a coffee, then you have a coffee on break, then lunch, then break. But at the ministry, just driving around site to site, I've asked 9-10 a day.
Oh, wow. Coffee, smoke, coffee.
It's the breakfast of champs, man.
It's coffee number 3, man.
So. Well, welcome back, man. It's good to see you.
Good to be back. It's been
a little while, probably over a year.
No, not over a year. The first episode I did with you was February of last year, and then I came back in with my cohorts there for the round table.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great.
March was there. Yeah, everybody.
Vince was there. I saw you had Frankie on. I love Frankie. Frankie's a very good man.
It was a blast. Yeah, everybody's more than welcome to come back.
Oh, yeah, for sure, man.
Yeah,
for sure. Sooner or later, we're going to run out of things to talk about.
No, it's construction. There's never a single thing to run out. There's always something new. As you guys always say, you get on job sites and you're never surprised anymore.
No.
I mean, listen, you know what? Change the industry and you'll be surprised. Like, get into hydropower construction, you'll be surprised. Wind power construction, you'll be surprised. But, you know, for the most part, construction's construction, no matter how you.
We hinted at that a little bit last time. We talked about how when they start building these certain structures, do they really factor in the safety elements of these structures? Because it's new ideas. Like, I saw recently
the engineers
online.
Engineers designing and the architects designing.
Yeah, there's a crescent building being built in Asia. And the way it's being built is absolutely, like, I can't wrap my head around it. The way this, so it's basically a big C wrapped around with two towers, and it's connected in the midpoint. And you're like, wow.
I can't speak to necessarily Asia, right? Because, I mean, every jurisdiction is going to have its different laws, right? And we saw what happened where was the World Cup?
Qatar.
We saw what happened in Qatar with the workplace fatalities and whatnot, but
they said it never happened. But
they don't record it.
I'm not here for for that. But at the same time, I'll say the working in hydropower, because that's currently where I'm at. Hydropower plants, in the construction of them, it's safety is. I'm going to say safety is probably 100 times better than it is in the construction industry, low rise and high rise, because everything is a hazard, right? Like the lockout tagout systems when you're doing hydropower plants and those components is insane. Like one wrong move and the penstock, fills up and people drown. So
the incident is that much greater.
It's catastrophic, right?
Wow.
And the components are... We're talking, 200 tons per component sometimes, right? So,
wow.
Just look at the size of hydropower plants. But then in wind energy, it's safety is really, really heavy in the energy sector. I mean, look at oil and gas out west.
How big's the team there? You're one of.
Yeah. I mean, North America, the team, I want to say just the safety team, probably around 20 to 25, wow. Right? But... The organization is global, does about 5 billion euro a year. But, I mean, you don't get safer than that industry.
Mm-hmm.
So,
Man, I can imagine it posed some challenges too, right? Different construction or different types of construction. You got to kind of think outside the box a bit when it comes to safety and how you're going to tackle some of these issues. But that's the fun part about safety, right? Different challenges and always pushing yourself and pushing your limits and trying to figure out how you're going to keep guys safe, keep workers safe, right?
Yeah. I mean, look, you know, what we're ultimately, that's what we're going to talk about today, right? What makes you effective as a safety professional? Because at the end of the day, we can only do so much.
Of course.
Right? We rely on the buy-in and the involvement of every worker.
It's a horse trough, right?
Right. It's, look, you know, and I'll get into it more, but we are advisors at best, right? We have to advise people on what the safest way to do things are, regardless of what the title is, whether you're a consultant, a director, a vice president, a coordinator, whatever it is. Our job is to build champions, right? And if we can build champions among the workers and among the management, then, you know, we'll have done our job effectively.
So that's our topic today, safety leadership.
Yeah, what makes safety professionals effective at their job?
Sounds good. Let's jump into it.
Okay.
Right, but, you know, just so you know, Phil didn't write these, I wrote these.
Yeah, just to put it out there, John created today's PowerPoint. Oh, we're giving
credits now to everybody. Okay.
No, I have to turn around to look, right?
John created the PowerPoint, and it's a lovely PowerPoint. John, by the way, very professional.
Did Phil edit after you created it?
No, absolutely.
Okay,
not.
You didn't give him time to edit.
It was perfect. You didn't need to. But...
So what happens?
It starts off with keep it simple, pretty much.
Keep it simple, right? So know your audience, right? On the corporate side, we got to remember as safety professionals that the corporation's goal is to make money, right? That's the organization's goal. So business continuity and an awareness of business continuity will make a safety professional, you know, very effective, right? Because that's our job. We work ultimately, unless we're working for the government, right? Even consultants, we work for the organization. We have to ensure that they're business continues to run, right? Now, when you do safety properly, right, that's how we ensure it by, you know, avoiding incidents, avoiding fatalities, right? Keeping jobs running as opposed to shut down, keeping the organization out of court for things like that. But, you know, as professionals, we always, especially if we work for an organization, we have to remember business continuity has to be on our top priority list, right? Not at the expense of safety. But we all have to work together, right? On the worker side, we have to understand who we're talking to, right? Speak to our workforce with respect. And I'm not just talking about, you know, carpenters and cement finishers and millwrights. I'm talking about project managers, coordinators, management. Like, we have to understand who we're talking to, right? I don't like to dictate anything in safety, right? So
you have to educate.
100%. We have to work together, right, to come up with the solution. I can't come and bop you on the head with a procedure.
You're not going to learn it that way.
No, and at the end of the day, if I sit in an office and I write a procedure and I hand this out and say, okay, now this procedure is mandatory, the folks doing the work had no input on that procedure, it's not going to work. No. They're not going to follow it, right?
No, they want to be a part of it.
You got to be part of it. So what I do as a professional is if I'm going to make a procedure, it's not my name signing off on the procedure, right? The procedure is going to be created by, you know, person X, John Smith, created this procedure or practice for installing guardrails, right? And then I will co-sign it. I'll sign off on it, right? But they have to be involved in the creation of that. And again, it creates ownership, right? So I don't like the idea of just building something, saying, here, go do it. Never works.
Maybe if you signed it John Wick, people might actually pay attention more. No. But I was going to ask you, when it depends on, the severity of the incident. When a company does go into court and there's a case going on, is the company shut down for that time?
No.
It still runs.
It will still run, right? So now, generally speaking, when it gets to court, we're talking a year now, 2 years, because the limitation date was extended, right? We're talking 2 years, you know, past the point of incident. So usually I would only shut down the job as an inspector. I would only shut down the job for the period of time that I needed to, right?
To investigate.
Even at the ministry, there was an understanding about, you know, ensuring that we're not, I guess, limiting the organization's ability to make any money at all, right? Mm-hmm. So we would only shut it down for as long as we needed to shut it down under a 54-1I to not disturb or anything like that. Only shut it down for as long as we absolutely needed to gather the information. Now there's other, you know, cases where it's been shut down for much, much longer, but it's at the discretion of the inspector and, by that time, legal services branch. So... Sure.
All right. Do you want to read this, Phil? So then we don't have to get John all the time turning around to look at it, but...
Sure.
That would be helpful.
Yeah, sure.
I'll read John's words.
Yeah, I'm on it. All right. Keep it simple. Know your audience. On the corporate side, we have to understand that business continuity and performance is and always will be the motivating factor. Safety in practice and in theory should run parallel to operations, working with each other as opposed to creating division or conflict. On the worker side, they want to feel protected, valued, and they want to contribute. So what are some of the challenges, John, that you face when creating new procedures or trying to get a message across to the workforce or even to management? Because sometimes, you know, we have a great idea or a new way to do things or a way to solve a problem, and you have to try to get buy-in from everybody. What are some of the challenges you encounter there?
Yeah, I mean, look, you're never going to get buy-in from 100%, right? There's always going to be an outlier, whether it's one individual working in the shop, whether, you know, that mechanic has been there for 30 years doing some a certain way, or whether it's, you know, the CFO of the organization. There's going to be discrepancy throughout, right? But when approaching the business, right, the business has to understand that safety is, you know, it comes with a cost, and the lack of safety comes with an even potentially higher cost, yep. Right? And when we're talking to businesses, ultimately, look, humans run businesses, right? So I like to think that most, and I'm lucky enough that in my interactions, most of the companies that I've dealt with genuinely care about their workforce. There are companies out there that don't, right? I've had experiences at the ministry, and so has Phil, where we've seen companies who don't. However, most of the companies I've had the pleasure of working with and for care about people, so it's been a little bit easier to sell the human side of safety to them. Not even so much a sell, right? They value their they workers' lives.
It, yeah.
But, you know, when we're talking about safety investment, safety, you know, I like to say that safety doesn't make you money necessarily. It saves you money, right? It's a preventative effect. Now, when you're, you know, going to an employer and saying, hey, look, I need more budget for my safety department, right? I need to take my safety department from $1 million to $1.5 million. Well, that $500,000 is going to have to be justified somehow, right? So there's always some challenge when dealing on the corporate level with the money side of things and the financial side of things, right? On the worker side, it's difficult and it's not. It's all about approach. Like if I come there and I start bashing you on the head with policies that I wrote that you had no say in, that you had nothing to do with, and then I tell you, okay, well, you're going to be disciplined if you don't follow this procedure, really, what friends am I winning in that game?
Yeah, and that, I guess that's the challenging part too as a safety professional. You want to create something such as a health and safety policy and program or specific procedures or come up with a game plan to how to address a specific problem. And you create it, but it's extremely important to understand the scope of work or the problems you're trying to solve, right? And a lot of times, you know, people will copy and paste or try to come up with a solution that's already been implemented somewhere else and try to adapt it and stuff like that. And sometimes it works.
Is that a bit of laziness?
You know, it's trying
not
to...
Should you not be going into the situation? Like, here's a fresh situation.
Listen,
this is what we need to achieve.
I always like to go on ride-alongs before I create anything for any company, especially when we get on new clients. I like to eat and breathe that scope of work for a few days before, right? Before I create any health and safety programs or anything like that. But going back to John's point, you know, dealing with management, dealing with the workforce, you got to be relatable. And there's times where you approach management to try to solve an issue and there's no appetite for it, right? As a consultant, you know, you provide the best advice that you can. Not everybody's going to agree with you. Not everybody wants to do what you're asking them to do. You know, it becomes challenging at times, you know, and economically too. And John's right. It does cost money. And some people aren't in that position, right? You know, I can't afford to do this or to do that. It's going to cost extra time or extra money, right? So it does become challenging at times. But that's the sign of a good safety professional, one that can deal with challenges and overcome them and adapt to them and kind of put in the best foot forward, I guess, in terms of trying to solve problems.
There's a difference too between, you know, Phil used the word program, which I think is a better word to describe the, you know, a system within an organization. But a policy can be cookie cutter, right? You mm-hmm. A policy in and of itself, for the most part, can be cookie cutter. It's the procedures and the practices that deal directly with the work that can't be cookie cutter, right? So, again, I separate, and I understand that safety professionals generally understand this, but many other people won't. There's a difference between a policy and a procedure or a practice, right? So, again, you can have a cookie cutter policy. You may need to kind of adjust and amend in certain areas, obviously, but yeah, the procedures are the most important part.
And even when writing these programs and policies and procedures, they have to be, you know, like, they can't be too rigid either. You shall right. do this step by step by step by step. Okay. But the real world doesn't run like that, right? There's variables. And, you know, what happens if it's like this? Or what happens if it's like that? Or what happens if, you know, can't reach there? Or whatever it may be. So even though you write these procedures, you're still hoping that the workers have some common sense. They're able to look at the procedure, understand the procedure, take the best parts out of that procedure that are applicable at the time, right? And try to use that information to solve whatever problem or safety challenge they're having on site. So there's some soft skills when it comes to the workforce or a supervisor or a foreman or a project manager, all these titles.
It's all soft supervisor. Skills. It's all soft skills.
Well, yeah. Yeah, you're right. There is a lot of soft skills, right? And it comes down to understanding, communication, prevention, you know, being relatable with the workers. But some guys have different techniques, and we've been in construction long enough. You know, you still got that old foreman that's screaming at the top of his lungs, "Hey, blah, 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 you're not tied off, get your harness," right? That kind of works too, you know, to an extent.
But as health and safety consultant, you guys come in regarding the leadership position, you still have to have an understanding of the widgets that that company is creating.
Right.
Like, for sure.
You can't mess, you can't shake up the jar of bees to the point where.
No. And you're never going to be successful in doing that, right? So you're either going to shake the bee jar among the workers, or you're going to shake it at the corporate level.
Yeah.
Either way, you're going to get stung, you know, 100 times, and it's going to suck. But the reality is this. I don't write a procedure for anybody. If I have to make a procedure for you, let's just say, Manny, that you are a bricklayer, okay? And we got to create a procedure for how you're going to erect your scaffold and then get on, you know, get up on top of it, right? As a safety professional. Now, look, I've laid bricks in the past, right? But I'm going to kind of remove my construction background and operate solely as a safety professional that's never actually done the work, right? If I look at the law and I say this and this and this and this is what you have to do to build a scaffold, and I build that procedure for you, you've been doing this for 30, 40 years, you're going to look at that, you're going to say, oh, okay, thanks, sign your name, and I'm going to leave, and you're going to do it the way you've been doing it from the start. So I would rather talk to you and say, okay, you and me, we're going to sit down, right? How do you erect the scaffold? Oh, this is how I do it. Okay, so let's start writing this down. And we're going to go through step by step how you do it. And then I'm going to look and I'm going to say, okay, well, listen, you know, you climb up the side of the scaffold to get up onto the scaffold. You're not allowed to do that, right? You need to have access and egress by way of a ladder. So, you know, can we install this ladder? Well, yeah. Well, Manny, you don't really have a choice. Where do you want to put the ladder on this procedure, right? And I'm going to involve you in that process.
Where can we put the ladder?
Right.
And then
where
can them we put to the make ladder? The
right. So if you own the procedure, right, if you've created the procedure, you're going to be much more likely to follow that procedure, right? Because all we've done is we've taken your expertise and your comfort in how you've done it. We're making it, we're plugging in my safety expertise, and we're making it functional. There's a difference between technical safety and functional safety, right? And they touch fingertips, but they both have to work. If I build something for you, you're going to be like, well, who is this guy? Why am I, you know?
It doesn't go as far.
Right, exactly.
It's a bit of selling too, right? You got to, how do you convince people? And I think this is the biggest challenge for any safety professional. How do you convince people to change or look at something that they're used to differently and then change themselves a bit?
It's construction, man.
I know. But, and this is the biggest challenge. And, you know, safety professionals, they get a job. They start working at a company that's a 7 or an 8 where everything's nice and laid out. The program's already done. They just got to maintain and kind of coast with it. Great. They come up with challenges. There's challenges. They deal with the problems. Fantastic. But I think the biggest challenge in safety is when you take a company that's a zero. I mean, they have no hard hats. They don't even have boots. They PPE, what's that? And you can take that company that's a zero, and this transformation takes a while, and get them up to a seven or an eight in terms of how they approach their work safely, right? And change their attitude a bit and come up with a game plan and actually follow that game plan and actually buy into safety, right? There has to be a bit of a buy-in here. And again, we've talked about health and safety programs. Yes, but it's like, it's commitment. It's like going to the gym.
Yeah, it's true.
Right? The company says...
It doesn't happen overnight.
It doesn't happen overnight. You need to be consistent. You need to be on top of it. You need to set your parameters, your boundaries, your expectations. And that's part of the challenge of being a safety professional. And this is one of the biggest challenge, I think, in our industry, right? It's where you come in as a safety professional in terms of that organization. You come in as the safety professional for Joe's Roofing that has 10 guys and, you know, nobody ties off, versus you come into a company that's well established, that makes millions of dollars, and they have budgets and they have safety teams. It's a different world. And even with our topic today and leadership at that level versus leadership at this level, yes, I think there's a lot of similarities, but there's some rough edges when it comes down in terms of that organization. But that takes us to John's next slide here. Create champions organically. The most effective way to build a culture of safety within any organization is through building natural safety champions. What does that mean, John? Natural safety champions.
Involve the people, right? Involve your...
Basically what you guys have been talking about.
Exactly. Involve your workers, right? We have to create champions, right? A good safety professional is part of the group, right? Not outside of it, not on the management side, not on only the worker side. We're a part of that overall fabric of the organization. You know, I used to say to my safety team and my previous employer, we are the bridge, right? We are the bridge. We have to be sturdy, right? Because this is how people connect those two sides, the management and the workforce. Creating natural safety champions is, like I said to you, I'm going to help you build this procedure. I'm going to put your name on it. I'm going to co-sign for you, right? Once you own that, right? Once you own that, there's a sense of pride to that. Yep. Just like the wall that you built, or the bridge that I built, or, you know, that 3 kilometers of sewer that I did on, you know, Dundas or whatever it is. There's a sense of pride in that. Like, how many times do we drive by a site and say, I say it to my wife all the time. She hates it, right? But I'm like, oh, you know, I worked on that bridge. I was over there. You know, I actually did, I worked on the mausoleum at the cemetery. Like, the weirdest things that you would think about, you get proud of, right?
Somebody, some team, right. Some people.
So, yeah. Again, the way to create natural champions is to involve them. Make them part of the process, right? Like, look, you know, I'm a big writer on LinkedIn. If anybody kind of sees, you know, my LinkedIn profile, I'm a big writer.
I do.
And I know you do. But I created an acronym and I called it the Circle, right? And there's a whole explanation of that on my LinkedIn. But it's about collaboration, you know, involvement, respect, communication, leadership, and education. Right? That's the Circle acronym.
Yeah.
And if you employ all of those within your safety practice, you're going to build natural champions. But the big one in there is respect and involvement. Respect them. Right? Show them respect.
Go further.
Exactly.
Pretty much in any situation.
I think so. In any situation, I think, you know, the workers start losing respect when they start bringing issues to your attention and they get dismissed or they don't get resolved. You know, there's an opposite effect to buy-in. You know, you want buy-in, you want to show people that you're resolving issues, that you're trying to protect them, that you're trying to make the workplace safer. But on the flip side of that too, workers have issues and they want to have discussions, and it's very easy to destroy everything you've built by losing that respect. That mm-hmm. respect that you have for workers, you know, oh, yeah, we'll get to it. And then you as a safety professional never address it. Oh, yeah, you know, you dismiss that. And I've seen it happen. And, you know, as soon as you turn around, the worker's like, fucking safety guy. You're like, oh, I try to tell him, it doesn't help me. It doesn't, you know.
There's a point, though, Phil. Like, what I like to say is this, okay? If you're bringing your safety concern to me, you've already failed. you've missed a whole bunch of steps in the first place. Yeah. Like, if it's gotten to me, right, the first thing I'm going to say is, if you're a worker, for example, right, the first thing I'm going to say is, okay, did you bring it to your foreman? Right. If the answer is no, I'm going to tell you to go back and bring it to your foreman, and I'll be with you throughout the process. Right. But if you brought it to your foreman and they didn't do anything, okay, did you escalate it to your supervisor? Right. And I get there's this whole fear of reprisal. Right. But at
the same, it's real.
It is. But at the same time, I say this all the time, and I said it at the organization I was with. I'll say it in any organization that I go to. I am not a cop. Right. You're not going to come report a crime to me, and then I'm going to march in and kick some doors down and start yelling at other people, right?
I wish the cops did that.
My modus operandi is to help you solve the problem, right? And if because I'm going to tell you, 9 out of 10 times, it's easily solved.
But you're primarily going in there to avoid problems from arising to begin with. But then once a problem does rear its head, you're right there to assist with solving that problem.
Consider the work refusal process in Ontario, right? Mm-hmm. You can't just call the ministry and the ministry comes and says, oh, yeah, no, this is... No, you can't do that. If you're refusing to work, there's a process involved legally, right? It's got to go to the Joint Health and Safety Committee. It's got to go to supervision. Then they got to inspect it, and they'll make a determination, likely to endanger, not likely to endanger. Mm. If they decide not likely to endanger, they can then assign somebody else to do that work. You still don't have to do it. That's when you call the ministry, and the ministry will come in and say, did you go through your process? Did you go through your steps? Then they will investigate if you've gone through all those steps, and they will make their determination of likely to endanger, not likely to endanger. So I treat it the same way. If you're coming to me with a problem, but you've skipped, you know, a whole bunch of people in between, listen, I appreciate you coming to me with that problem, but that's not what building safety champions is about. No. If you've come to me with that problem to begin with, then I've done a piss poor job of building a champion, because I want you to have the courage and the confidence to say to your, you know, foreperson, hey, look, there's no trench box in this trench, I'm not going to go in there. And then I want that person to say, hey, you know what, you're right, I didn't even think about that, here, call the shop, let's go get a box. Yeah. That's what a functional safety champion does. But if you're bypassing those steps, you're coming straight to me. No, I want to help you solve your problem. I don't want to come in, lay the hammer down and say, you know, ba beep ba 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 ba, and that's it.
And to add to John's point here, and not to sound like I'm not agreeing, because that works very well when it's linear. All the issues are within one organization. You know, you start getting the variables now where, excuse me, you're a subcontractor on a project, and maybe the safety issue doesn't belong to you guys. It's not my safety issue. It's not my team's safety issue. Guardrails are missing all on this entire floor, and I have to work on this floor. It becomes a constructor issue. Mm-hmm. And you're now dealing with another party in that mix that John just said, right? So yes, you may have an issue. Yes, you may address it with your supervisor. Yes, you may have the communication and do all these things, but you need to go talk to the constructor. What happens if the constructor says, yeah, we'll get to it?
Right? Then call me when you get the guardrails up. Or what if
the constructor actually goes and does it?
Ideal situation,
which is what you want.
Now, right? if they don't,
challenges arise when they don't, and you know, a lot of constructors, and depending, high rise, for example, a majority of constructors say, "Yeah, no problem. We're going to get onto it. We'll send somebody. Boom, problem solved within half an hour.
Right.
Great, yes.
Right."
But you run into these challenges in infill housing, for example. I'm building a house on Bridal Path or something, Mississauga Road, some nice big house, right? And you get there and there's issues. Guardrails are missing. I got to work. I'm the plumber. I got to work on the second floor. There's guardrails missing everywhere.
Right.
Do you still have that flexibility or that freedom or that ability to voice your concern and get the issue addressed, and it will get addressed in a timely manner? That's where the variables start happening. That's where the challenges start happening. So different sectors or different types of construction. Right. Sorry, guys. I got a bit of a frog in my throat today. But
ribbit.
Yeah. Different sectors, different construction projects, different attitudes, right? And a lot of these constructors' attitudes, especially in high rise, if you compare it to back in the 90s, their attitude is not the same as it was back then.
No.
You know, they've had fatalities, they've had issues, they've had stop work orders, right? So they have a little bit more buy into safety or a better reason or more reasons. They've been taught differently in terms of,
let's talk a little bit about money. Just on a side note, on, do you guys ever, when you're consulting, get into an asset allocation? And the reason I bring this up is because I love at the beginning of the show, you started talking about how safety costs, but it's going to save you money as well too. And on previous shows, you guys have said that what is the cost of not being safe, which is always higher than being safe, right? So do you guys create an asset allocation bucket list where it's like, here's what it's going to cost to do all this safety, to build all this safety awareness, to work with the employees, to work with the executives, and here's what you potentially will save as a result of doing that.
So I have, working within the organization, because a consultant generally won't come in and do that cost allocation. And I've worked with plenty of consultants, right? They won't, unless they're a financial consultant, and they're not really going to do that because the consultant doesn't have power within the organization, right? They are a hired gun. So if a consultant comes to, the employer and says, hey, listen, I think this, this, and this, the employer can look at the consultant and say, yeah, that's too bad. I don't have the funds to do that. How much am I paying you again? Right, within the organization,
you can do that. Pay out in a trial, in an incident.
Exactly, and a good consultant. So Kevin Brown, right? Kevin Brown from Cobalt, phenomenal. He's a friend of ours. He's been, one of my mentors for a very long time. Kevin does that cost breakdown phenomenally, right? Mm-hmm. And it's included in his materials, right? When he pitches his services to an organization, or even when he has conflict within an organization that's hired him, he'll bring you back to that number. So there are consultants that do it. It's much easier to do it when you're employed by the organization, right?
And smaller info, harder?
Smaller info is much, much harder because you got to remember, look, the cost of housing is bananas for everybody, right? So now I just bought a house that cost me $2 million in St. Clair and Dufferin. Now I'm going to tear it all down. I'm going to sink another $3 million into it. And you always know it goes over budget, right? So when you're factoring in those costs for an infill home builder, right? Maybe it's not even, they don't do it full time. They're building their own home.
But that's what the builder first brings up at the very beginning. When you guys come in and start talking about safety, their first question is, what's this going to cost?
Exactly. Yeah. So as the ministry, I will tell you, as the ministry, my go-to was, here's the max fine you can face as the constructor, right? There's also, C-51 in the criminal code, right? So here are the potential ramifications of not doing this. And, I've said that to people as an inspector. I've said, what the top fines are now, right? Do you want to go back into some case law? We can look at it. It was much easier as an inspector to sell safety because you had no choice.
You're not really selling it at that point.
But at the same time, I think that what these home builders have to understand is, if it's going to save you $5,000 to not guardrail, different levels of your house, it's going to cost you $500 when somebody falls and dies. Right? It's fairly simple math. Now, I understand that not every contractor, look, everybody in this room knows contractors that no matter how many times you tell them about safety, they're not going to do it because it's going to cost too much, or they won't get that job, or I can't bid this job and include the trench box because I won't get the job. Somebody will come do it lower. Look, we all know people in the room like that. Mm-hmm. So sometimes with some people, it doesn't matter how many times you tell them. I've been in construction for, 32 years now. No, not 32. Long time. I don't know. We're in the 28s or something like that.
a few decades.
A few decades.
When the memory starts going.
Been in construction a very long time. Okay. And I look at these younger business owners that have a presence on social media, because social media is, let's face it, right? It
sucks.
That's how you make your money. I mean, look at Phil's page. It grew exponentially, right? So, but I see a lot of these young business owners and they're playing their hip hop in the background, and they have these cut scenes and all this stuff. And I'm looking going, oh yeah, that trench is near collapse. Or I'm looking going, oh yeah, look, those guys on the roof.
Don't be the social media police.
Listen,
man.
Those guys on the roof, they're definitely going to die if they fall. Right. And so it doesn't matter.
It's true though.
It's 100% true.
That's our entire next episode is social media and
but
employers
on
social media.
The point that I'm making is that it doesn't matter how many times, certain people, it doesn't matter how many times you talk to them about it, they just don't get it. And actually, we had a conversation about this with, we have a kind of a WhatsApp group of former ministry inspectors, right? and generally we talk almost every day, right? Somebody always has a question, but you know, Phil posted a video that one of the people in the group, another former inspector, said, "Hey, you know, that's a bit controversial. Maybe we shouldn't show, you know,
it's controversial. It was graphic.
It was graphic. Maybe we shouldn't show that." And I, you know, I was on the flip side to that, saying, "No, some people need to see this."
Right? I think what so. Was it?
It was somebody got crushed by a precast that was being hoisted off of a truck, right? He folded in half. But now, for a guy like Phil or I mean, as weird as it sounds, that's kind of not abnormal to see. So we're a bit used to it. But some people need to see videos like that. And I hate to say it, and I do not wish this on anybody, but some people will not change until something happens.
It comes down to the old saying. You either learn the easy way or the hard way. The easy way, you have a consultant, you have a safety professional, whatever it may be, provides you advice, put practices and procedures into place, protect your company, boost you guys up. Yes, it costs time. Yes, it costs money. But in the long run, it is cost effective if you are able to avoid and prevent going to court or having an injury or fatality. And then on the flip side, there's companies that don't learn until they get charged or until they have a serious injury or fatality. And then they'll start changing their tune a bit. But even companies that have been charged multiple times, even there's some hard-headed testaduda guys out there that they just don't care, right? And what was the name of that roofing company or that guy? Didn't he had lost his ability to do roofing because of so many charges he got?
I don't remember the name of the company. Was that here in Ontario? It was in Ontario, so that was the first of its kind.
The
so
guy's banned from roofing.
He can't start a roofing company anymore. Now, he can go work for a roofing company, but he can't own his own roofing company anymore.
There's loopholes.
Right. There's always going to be loopholes.
The reason I said social media sucks is primarily for the reason that it's the same way that if you watch a TV show or a movie today versus what you watched as your, I'm still scarred from Jaws because I was too young to watch it. We're desensitizing people from watching these videos of these people being crushed. That's why I say it sucks. Like I know that you shared, and I think I sent it to you about the bundle of rebar that landed right on a person. Mm-hmm. And you're like, that person's gone. There is no injury report. That person is gone. Done. Right. And the thing is, most people will look at it and go on, that's a shame. That's terrible. It sucks. Loss of life, but not my job site. Not my area. Right. It's not in my scope.
But that's been that way forever. I mean, even if you couldn't see it on social media, news and construction always travels fast, right? Especially if you're industry to industry.
Does it change the constructors that are
seeing sometimes it? Yes and sometimes right. No. Like, so we would hear, you know, I'm going back to, let's go back to 2006, right? I'm working Mavis and Dundas. Oh, no, it was even before that. I was at Mavis and Dundas. 2006, I was in Burlington building a bridge, okay? And we hear about, you know, a worker that died building a bridge in Kenora, Ontario. Like, news travels very quickly.
Yeah, very fast.
But it doesn't necessarily change the company until it happens to you. Now, listen, that's a company that's totally reactive, right? Most of the big and well-functioning companies have proactive safety, but they realize the value in that proactive safety. But, you know, to Phil's point, there are a lot of companies that multiple fatalities, they still haven't changed their tune, or, you know, they're waiting for something bad to happen. And I wish, look, you know, I was saying this to another safety person the other day in conversation. I wish that none of us had jobs. Because if none of us had jobs, it would mean the whole world, you know, everybody's going safe home to their families at the end of every day. I don't see that happening, right? Because humans are fallible creatures. As long as there's humans doing the work, there's going to be a need for safety professionals. However, I think that everybody has the ability, everybody, regardless of your trade, can be a safety professional. You can be a carpenter full-time and a safety professional part-time. Mm-hmm. All you got to do is just look out for each other. Mm-hmm. Understand the tools you're using, the components to the systems that you have. When I say safety professional, I should say safety practitioner.
The safety rep.
Yeah, right, I think everybody has the ability to be a professional safety person.
Sure. Listen, it's just promoting positive habits and promoting positive change and you know, taking the leadership, again, leadership in the field in terms of, you know, we've done it like this, but we're going to change it and we're going to do it a little better. Or, you know, a lot of it's looking in the mirror and saying, how can I be a better supervisor? How can I be a better worker? How can I do my job safely? Or how can I protect the workers around me? You know, because, again, there's that trust thing. And there's been plenty of times where, you know, one worker screws up. They don't put the guardrail back. And then, you know, an hour later, someone falls through that opening.
It's a good idea. I just thought about, you know, how mostly on high rise, there's your safety box, your safety camper, or
like a job box.
Not a job box, but where board. You sign in and the board. You sign in and everything like that. Put a mirror there and just have a question over that mirror. How can you be a better fill in the blank? Dot, dot, dot.
Yeah,
you
know it works. It's like too. Something I posted once is safety starts with me, and it's a mirror.
It's
and
a mirror.
Yeah, and you open up
no,
the
box. No, it says who's responsible for safety.
I think that makes sense.
You know, the other thing is that, you know, instead of writing safety talks for people, make people write their safety talks. I used to stand in. I used to stand in a circle, and instead of, you know, providing you with the, excuse me, a pre-filled out safety talk, I would say, okay, listen, I got a blank sheet of paper. What are we talking about today? And I would go around, right, and I'd be like, okay, you want to talk about fall hazards? Okay, Phil, where do you see fall hazards on this site? Oh, you know, they're over there, there, and there. Yeah. Okay, Manny, how would you prevent yourself from falling there? And I would involve that conversation, engage that conversation. And then I would. You know, at the ministry, another good thing that I learned was that I would confirm that you understood what I was saying, right? And I'd employ that tactic even when I'm delivering a group safety talk and everybody's involving, right? So after it, I'll be like, hey, listen, how many things did you point out? Oh, this. And Manny, how did you say that we were going to?
Oh, yeah.
And I would go through it that way, right? I think that there's, you know, that's an effective way to incorporate people.
For sure.
And at the end of the day, there's no excuses.
Nope.
Right? You can't just, because I will tell you, the ministry will pull you into a room, pull every single safety talk you've ever signed your name to, right, in the last year or month or whatever it is, and say, hey, didn't you sign this talk? Hey, you know, Mr. Supervisor, you actually delivered this, didn't you? That's your name there, right? Oh, yeah, okay. Well, did you sign this policy too? If people don't know what's going on, it doesn't matter how shiny your binders are, the company is not protected. And I've said that before. And it's confirming with everybody in the room that you know exactly what we're doing, when we're doing it, and how to keep each other safe.
And John, we've done training classes together. One of the ones we've done is investigation training and fatality breakdowns and stuff like that.
That's where we made people cry.
I didn't make anybody cry. You made someone cry, but I couldn't believe that. But that men? Being...
yeah, well, yeah. Yeah, but men cry.
John's ruthless, man.
I'm not ruthless. It's
honest.
At the end of the day, we did a staged... Phil and I, you know, built a course where we staged an event.
Like,
and we actually went out. We staged, you know, a scene where a crane had contacted an overhead line, and we painted a body on the floor. And I had the class go out and start taking their notes. And then I had Phil show up as a ministry inspector. And then we did a cross-examination and a statement and all that. Yeah, all that stuff. So it was pretty intense. And somebody ended up, you know, getting...
Not crying. He didn't cry.
Yeah, he got very frustrated, right? But I've listened.
Got a little emotional.
I teach a course that's based on the first fatality ever investigated. And there has been a lot of wet eyes in that room during that course. But again,
and you're just doing an outline of the person?
No, I go through his whole life. I talk about who he was.
No, but on the physical.
Yeah, it's just
an outline. Oh, on the physical thing. It's just an outline.
I'll volunteer to be the person. Throw a little bit of blood on me and I'll be there.
Oh, you want to be the pretend dead guy?
I had a dummy 1 year. I had a dummy on the ground 1 year.
They'll be like, is that Manny?
But, sorry to interrupt, Phil.
No. Listen, man, there's no apologies at this table. But
moving on, where are we looking?
Where are we at?
We're not here, a cop. It's funny, you guys. I know you guys did this amazing. Well, John did this amazing PowerPoint.
Well, this is all John.
But yeah, the thing is that you guys are discussing all this stuff. You're discussing. You're bringing all these key points, right? You guys are not cops, right?
Look.
These guys will disagree, but I feel that there's always an element of enforcement when it comes down to safety. Okay, and enforcement is a style of verifying that people are following the rules that you've laid out in terms of getting things done. Now, there has to be a bit of enforcement, and they'll say a little bit, I'll say a lot, but there has to be a level of enforcement here because you need to verify that people are following the rules.
Mm-hmm. Phil took off the ministry hard hat, but very faintly, you could still see the Ontario leaf tattooed on his forehead.
The three guys in the hot tub?
The three men in a hot tub is what the old Trillium used to look like. But look.
Three guys in a hot
that's
tub?
That's what it looks like.
What I will
joke
say,
about it all the time, the new logo.
You know, Phil has said that I'll disagree.
Thank you, Doug.
Phil has said that I'll disagree, and I won't disagree. There's a place for enforcement, okay? There's always a place for enforcement. Without enforcement, nothing happens, okay? Yeah. But my view on enforcement is very different. I had heavy enforcement when I was at the Ministry of Labor. I think I led the entire ministry for a year straight in charges laid.
It's because I wasn't there at the same time.
So, But yeah, be proud, Phil. But look, it's there's always a place for an enforcement. I led heavy enforcement. I was involved heavily in enforcement with the Ministry of Labor. But I'm going to tell you right now, right? On the private side, there's a place for discipline. There's a place for enforcement. But the safety team shouldn't be the one handing out the disciplines, right? We shouldn't be writing people up. No. What we should do is say, look, we've observed this, right? We've tried to correct it. It didn't get corrected, or we got pushback here, or they didn't listen here. Operations needs to take action, right? Because what you're doing there is you're giving ownership back to operations. But you need to establish, and I understand that operations can go, yeah, no problem. I'll do that, no, and that's it.
But operations taking your direction.
Right, they're taking our direction.
You're not doing the dirty work.
But it's not that we're not doing the dirty work, because at the end of the day, they have to own it, right? The my old, the owner of the company that I used to work for, fantastic, fantastic people. But one of the owners kind of told me when I started there, he's like, they need to own their own safety. The presidents of my companies are fully responsible and fully accountable for safety, so they need to own it, right? So I don't agree with the, you know, the safety advisor going out. Maybe, you know, at the director of safety VP level, it changes a little bit, but the advisor shouldn't be going out and saying, hey, look, I'm writing you up because you didn't wear a hard hat today. No, I'm going to tell you to wear your hard hat. Right? I'm writing you up because you weren't tied off, right? We shouldn't be writing anybody up. I'm going to make my notes. I'm going to tell you to tie off, right? If you absolutely refuse, I'm going to pick up the phone. I'm going to call somebody above, you know, the GM, the operations manager, whatever it is. I'm going to say, look, this is what I'm looking at right now, right? How do you want me to handle this? I'll take my direction from you. When it comes to write up, right? Because a lot of times your bonus is tied to your performance and safety, you know, safety is a part of that. So I'll say that operations has the authority and the responsibility to issue discipline to their own people. Right, I'm there to advise you, to help you, to guide you, right? But the minute I come in and I slap you on the ass, I'm no longer, you know, you're no longer going to trust me at that point in time. And within an organization, maybe it's different for a consultant. Within an organization, the minute you break that trust, you've lost that person.
I don't think it's different between a consultant or an in-house safety professional.
How long have you been in-house, bro?
I think that there's different. Listen, I'm the safety professional for a lot of companies. And depending on the scenarios, depending on the client, depending on the goals that need to be achieved, sometimes you have to come in a little heavy-handed. Here's a scenario. One of my clients is low-rise carpentry. They have 40-something crews on their job site. Languages is tricky at the best. You got Portuguese, you got Spanish, you got a mix of a variety of different attitudes, different people. Some of them are illegal. Some of them, it's a crazy shit show sometimes. My client says, Philip, you enforce the way you need to make sure you need to enforce to ensure that we are following all the safety rules.
Are you the only safety guy there?
Hold on a second. So my job is to go out there, teach, communicate, train, ensure. Okay. Make sure that everyone is putting up their guardrails, the railings, and this and that. What happens if they don't? A, someone can fall. B, they can get shut down. Or C, the constructor shuts them down. Right? Madame Holmes or Tribute, whatever. Hey, you did this is wrong. You guys got to fix all of this stuff, this and that. So what happens in that situation where you've told and done safety talks and done inspections and have talks and talked to the foreman, and it gets to a point where it's like, okay, when we've warned you three times.
Right.
You keep on doing this. You know what my client says? Says, Phil, send them home for a day.
Yeah. And
maybe
and
keep them home for 2 days until they learn. And where do they learn? They learn by losing money.
Right.
There's the cost of not doing safety. Do I take pleasure in sending workers home? No, I never do now. And I never did at the MOL. But sometimes it's a necessary evil, especially when you have all your other options exhausted.
Right.
I've tried. You can only tell a kid so many things so many times before you got to put them in a timeout. And if you're one of those parents or one of those safety professionals that takes a holistic approach to safety and says, please, please, please all the time, people might not always listen to you.
Right. That's now, all I'm saying. Different situations altogether, because what I described was a corporation.
Right.
Right. So now you're describing 40 carpentry crews. But, you know, my question stands. Levels. Are you the only safety person there?
No, I'm sure there's
I'm
one
for the
constructor.
I'm just
going
to go get a knife here so I can cut the tension.
No.
Look, you got to see our WhatsApp group, man. It's insane.
Manny, it's different perspectives because we talk about safety professionals and you can't paint the whole thing in one brush.
No.
Being a safety professional at this level, right? Like a lot of my clients, you know, they need help.
On the Phil scale, right?
So on the Phil scale of 1 to 10, they're a 1 or 2.
Now they need help. My exposure is in the corporate realm. Like I've never John worked for a small
of 7 and 8s.
Yeah, like I've never worked for a small company. Okay, like even within construction, when I didn't do safety at all, Dagmar Construction was one of the most well-respected civil still is one of the most well-respected civil contractors in the game. So I've never kind of my exposure to these ones and twos, you know, Joe's Roofing and Sal's Bricklaying was through the Ministry of Labor.
Yeah.
Right. So, but and again, these kind of small mom and pop organizations. Yeah, I can get where enforcement would come heavier, you know, from the safety professional side. At the end of the day, when you work within an organization and, you know, I've been fortunate enough to work with, I've been unfortunate enough to have like 14, 15 fatalities under my belt. But when you work with organizations that spend money to do safety, right? They hire a department. They you know, spend all the money that they have to. It's a very different approach, right?
Of course.
Those people, those safety people are the bridge between the organization and the workers. And the minute that, you know, I'm sending somebody home or I'm writing somebody up, I've lost that person. Now, on the flip side... Or maybe
you've gained them, John. You've never given out tickets and people said thank you to you? Because it's happened to me.
Phil,
thank you very much. Okay, Phil, I won't do it again.
You know what?
I
understand. Admittedly, I never gave out part one monetary fines. I always gave part one summons. So my entire career...
to a judge.
Yeah, my entire career at the Ministry of Labor. You want to talk about how heavy-handed in enforcement I was? I didn't give you a ticket for $200 for your hard hat. I sent you to court for not tying off.
Listen, right? That type of safety...
I would never say thank you.
No.
No, but people do.
Right. Look, I've never heard it. You know where I heard thank you?
I promise I won't do it again.
I heard thank you after, you know, taking statements regarding fatalities. That's when I heard the thank you, right? Yeah. And my first one, the first statement I ever took, audio recorded statement I ever took, was the brother of the deceased. So, you know, you're not going to get more personal than that for me.
No.
So I've never had anybody say thank you when I've charged them. But again, I've never given you chiclets. I've always sent you to court.
Yeah. Right? Listen, all I'm saying is that companies do have disciplinary policies and procedures. There is an expectation on the workforce. And if you let things slide, and you don't step in and discipline, you have the chance of losing all of your safety, not just that one worker or that one project. Because the other workers will say, well, if the boss doesn't say anything,
and
nobody's get away with
cared, it. And this is and why we're getting I made away the, with
it. Then yeah, then there's a good chance.
This is why I made the point to say that it's different at the level of a director or a VP or whatever, right?
Of course,
So if my team was coming up to me and saying, "Hey, look, you know, I keep going to this job site and this guy never has his outriggers down, and I always bring it up, I write it up, I email, you know, the operations manager, and nothing ever gets done about it." That's when your leadership, your safety leadership, will step in and say, "Okay, look, somebody's gonna pay for this, right?" And 9 out of 10 times. I would bring it to the managers. I would say, "This is your fault that this keeps happening, right?" So now me and you are being honest because the leadership is failing. If my team is telling you that this person never has their outriggers down, right? And we know how important outriggers are when you're using mobile cranes, and my team keeps telling you that you don't have your outriggers down and you do nothing about it, this is your failure. Yeah, not just the guys in the field.
No, I agree.
This is your failure. So at that level, then like I think at different levels within safety director, VP level, senior manager, then you get involved in the disciplinary process. But as a boots on the ground everyday safety professional, which sometimes that's the best life to live, right? As opposed to being stuck at a desk.
The
boots on the ground safety professional, I really don't, unless you're a mom and pops and you're the consultant there, you're the only one there that they've seen in 6 months, then yeah, fine, right? But if you're working within an organization, you should have advisor should have no inclination to discipline in that regard. Send it up the chain.
But your information will be used as part of that disciplinary process.
Right.
Your investigation, your notes, whatever it may be, will be used.
Right.
Part of that disciplinary process. So it's nice to say, it's not my responsibility, but you are assisting in the discipline of that worker. You're just not. Yeah.
So you're saying just cut out the middle steps, right?
I'm not saying that. But all I'm saying is that as an effective safety professional, you need to understand when to apply some pressure. You need to understand when to be relatable. You need to understand, like being a referee, John, you need to understand when to let some things slide and say, okay, we'll come back to this. Let's stick a pin in this one. Let's do a big circle here, talk to a few other people and come back and let's see if we can address this. You have to you have to have some tact. Right? You got to be tactical with how you're going to kind of address things. You have to be relatable. Right. And you have to understand what the hell you're talking about.
For sure. Now, look, everybody's experiences are going to bring them in different ways. Sure. Like I said, that WhatsApp group, when you said you're going to cut the tension with a knife, you got to see our WhatsApp group.
Stop talking about our
WhatsApp group. We'll have five different...
Stop talking about it. We do not have a WhatsApp group.
No, we have a WhatsApp group. But I'm not going to lie to you. But you'll see so many different opinions within that group itself. We have, you know, Kevin has his opinion on how he does business.
No, we're not naming names of the people in the group either.
They were on this show, you banana. You know, Vince has his way of doing things or whatever. So it's
I've never seen somebody name drop so hard to come on our show, man.
Hang on, let me fix the problem here. This episode was brought to you by S1 Consulting, the best consultant on planet Earth. Please call S1. Phil is the best. Phil is the best. So sorry for the name dropping of other people, but I just made up for
it. This has to go on LinkedIn, okay? Can you please keep it a little bit more professional?
It's been professional up until now.
Yeah.
I have a more important question. Do they still make Chiclets?
What, the gums? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just got some in the U.S.
Okay, all right. I didn't see them. I didn't pay attention.
I spend a lot of time in the U.S. these days.
Yeah, go ahead. I like this one.
Yeah, growth mindset, right? Understand that you don't know everything. The worst
doesn't matter who you are.
Doesn't matter who you are on the job, right? But for a safety professional in particular, understand that you don't know everything.
No.
Right? So go in there with a willingness to learn and an openness to learn, right? And understand, because I'm going to learn from you just as much as you're going to learn from me. And together, we're going to create a system or a procedure or a process that's going to make it safer for you to do the work and allow me to protect the organization. We all come from
different
job
sites, different projects. Right. We bring different value, different experience.
Again, just understand that you don't know everything. Yep. If you stand up there, listen, my thing is lead from the middle. Right. If you're going to lead from the middle, be part of that group. Because if you lead from the front, right, you're building followers. Right. Now, I'm not talking about going into battle. That's a different story. But if you're going to lead within an organization, lead from the middle. Involve yourself in the organization. Involve yourself in the work. Make people understand that I'm no better than you and no worse than you. Mm-hmm. Whether you're a carpenter and I'm the VP of safety or the director of safety or whether I'm the general manager of the company, I'm no better than you. We each serve different roles within the same organization. So lead from the middle. And when you lead from the middle, you have a better ability to develop a growth mindset, right? Because you're open to learn when you're leading from the middle. So there's a good book about, it's actually called Lead from the Middle. It's by a guy named Michael Bowman, who was a safety professional. Now he's in the U.S. He owns a company called Bowman Legacies. Fantastic book called Lead from the Middle. I would recommend it to anybody. And Mike probably doesn't even know who the hell I am. But anyway, it's a good book that kind of describes effective leadership and even the challenges within that leadership. But when you lead from the middle,
I like that.
You have a growth mindset. You're open to learn and you're open to be wrong, right? If I'm wrong, I'm the first one that's going to tell you, hey, look, you know what? You were right. You're absolutely right here. Right. I'm not going to dance around and try and fight you and prove my point, because there's a term for it, but which I can't recall off the top of my head, but people who have to be right all the time and can never admit that they're wrong will fail in the long run. Right? Because you're not open to learn. So if I have to defend my point and then I have to go look on the internet for sources, it's bias, right? That's pretty much what it is. If I say something and you say that I'm wrong and I go and I look at all of these bias sources that are just confirming my side and my opinion only, right?
You got to be open to different
opinions. What are you going to gain in that regard, right? No. So be open.
In construction, 100%. And one of the tactics that I like using a lot is asking a lot of questions.
You know what I mean? Let me figure out exactly where your head's at when this is happening. Let me find out exactly the scope of work. Let me ask questions to understand your knowledge. You know what I mean? You can't always assume that people know everything or people, when it comes to safety, you know, on a job site, oh, didn't you know that that guardrail was? How you approach things, how you approach problems, how you approach challenges, your ability to effectively communicate, your ability to understand, your ability to grasp information and kind of piece it all together, because you're always trying to take pieces of info and putting it together and trying to formulate a story or a series of events, you know, what led up to this, what contributed to that, you know, and you're right, John, ego has no place in safety, but confidence has a place in safety. And, you know, we teach courses, 20, 30, 40 people in a class. They're listening to us. They're looking up to us. They're relating to us and the information that we're providing. They're confident that this is a reliable source, this instructor in front of our class. They're confident that, you know, this guy knows what the hell he's talking about. This guy sounds like he's been around the block. This guy understands safety in a realistic perspective, compared to this guy just learned safety out of book and now he's talking to me about procedures that he doesn't
understand. But ego and confidence are two different things.
Yeah, 100%. Right. And I think, but they get mixed a bit in terms of people, you know, oh, this guy's just really cocky.
They get misinterpreted depending on how you come off. When I say that ego, I think, you know, I'm talking about the kind of existential ego, right? Mm-hmm. The philosophical ego, not the confidence or cockiness or whatever. I think that, you know, when you kind of dive into the word ego, right, it's the self, right? And if you have a big ego in safety, doesn't mean you're being too cocky or too confident. When you have a big ego in safety, you're not going to learn anything in safety. You're going to think that your way is the right way and there's nothing else to it, right? Yeah. That's what I mean by ego. There's confidence is different. And look, I used to start every class at the organization I was previously with. I used to start every class by saying, I respect every single one of you, and I'm going to learn just as much as you are today because you're going to teach me. And, you know, right now where I am, you know, I walk through plants that are manufacturing products that are 200 tons, right? And then I'm going on sites that are installing all of these components, right? And I say to every single person there, I am here to learn from you. Right? I am here to learn from you, to work with you so that we can protect you.
That's how a leader connects with them.
That's it. I'm not going to sit there and kind of dictate. There's this image that I have in my head, and I don't know why it's like, you know, those AI-generated images. It's like my head just generates it. But somebody standing on top of the trench with their arms crossed looking down at the people in the trench, that's not good leadership to me. Right? And that's not how safety should be led, right? If I'm standing there like this or with my hands on my hip and I'm barking commands at you, we're not going to get anywhere, right? No. I'm going to walk up to you. I'm going to ask you the question. What do you do? Like, you know, that's one of the tactics that we learn as inspectors. Ask questions to figure out what's going on before we just make assumptions, right?
Yeah, yeah. And that's key.
Right. And that's a huge look. If you're not asking questions, you're not in safety, right? No. You will not get anywhere. So, and every safety professional, whether you're a ministry officer or not, understands that questions are a super important part of doing your job. But again, you know, point of the story is that I would walk into these rooms. I say, I'm going to learn from you. You're going to learn from me, right? And I would ask them. I would say, this course, you know, I would even involve them in designing the course. Right. If I was up there teaching, you know, hoisting and rigging, I'm not a crane operator. I would much rather help a crane operator design that course just to make sure that they're hitting the points, you know, legally that they have to hit and the proper ways to do things. And I would much rather have that crane operator deliver hoisting and rigging. This is the point that I'm trying to make about, you know, not necessarily about this slide, but the point that I'm trying to make with all of this is that you send me for training. I go sit in a room with somebody who's never, ever run a crane telling me, you know, how to take care of my hoisting and rigging. No, thanks. I'd rather learn that from
listen to them.
100%. I would rather learn that from a crane operator. Yeah. So an effective safety professional would say to that crane operator, and look, the previous organization, professionals are doing this. You know, book 7 training was never delivered by the safety professional. It was delivered by the traffic control professional who implements these TLs every single day. So they were, you know, that organization still to this day, phenomenal leadership under somebody that I greatly respect. Her name's Jen.
Shout out to Jen.
She is, you know, she worked under me for 5 years. She is now the leader of safety at that organization. I cannot think of a better safety professional in my head. And, you know, she's doing a phenomenal job leading. But she's, you know, she's really amazing at that too. She will involve the people in building their own courses and delivering their own courses. So I would much rather learn hoisting and rigging from a crane operator. You want to talk about, if I'm doing a training class just on shoring boxes, yes, I can do that because I did pipe every single day for 10 years of my life, right? In and out of trenches. But you want me to teach you how to do hoisting and rigging? Sure, I can read off the slides, but what are you gaining from that?
Nothing.
So again, I think that that's where, you know, we have the most effect is involving people. And all of this, all of these slides, everything that we talked about, all boils down to involving the people who do the work. Without them, you don't have a job, number one. So respect them enough to involve them in the process of safety, involve them in creating the training programs, involve them in creating the procedures, involve them in creating the policies. Because at the end of the day, we are nothing without them. And our job is to protect the company and protect the workers. And if you protect the workers, you protect the company.
No.
Right?
Which one comes first?
They go hand in hand. When you protect the workers, you're protecting the organization that they work for. When you protect the organization but not the workers, you're not that's not an effective safety professional. You are a cleanup. You're a janitor at best, yeah. Right? Mopping up some blood. So, again, it's the truth, right?
I know.
It's the truth. If you are covering up,
sometimes, man, it's like, wow.
If you're covering up problems, if you're working for an organization that they don't take proactive action when it comes to safety, or you know. They just say, okay, listen, we'll call you when we need you type thing. You're a janitor, right?
It is what it is.
But at the end of the day, it's all about involvement. It's involving the people. I'll go back to saying it. A carpenter can be a safety professional. A cement finisher can be a safety professional. An electrician can be a safety professional. And they each are in their own ways with what they do. The electrician, you know, knows what is going to keep him or her safe, opening up a box, yeah. Right? Splicing wires together. That's a safety professional, right? Build on that professional's knowledge when you're building your procedures. The carpenter understands, you know, how to set up the pneumatic nail gun, right? What size nails to put in that gun? What clip has to go in there, right? Or if they're doing it the old school way, you know, how to swing that hammer and hit that nail once instead of 16 times. Yeah. They are the safety professional in what they do. Build on their knowledge. I like to say that we are safety practitioners, but there's safety professionals all around us.
Yeah, if they're working safe, right? Yes, a safety professional needs to pool or gather knowledge from different sources. But again, you want to make sure your source is good. If I get hired by a roofing company and none of their guys are tied off, I'm not going to ask them, you know, what measures and procedures should we put into place on how to tie off. I already know none of you guys tie off.
No, but you can always approach them and say, okay, listen, we know that everybody needs to tie off and that none of you are tying off, so let's create something together where we're both going to own off. It.
What's that? Right. Harness?
Yeah. What? Listen, there's nobody doing the work that doesn't understand that they need to be tied off at heights, right? So I will go to you.
I don't know about that.
Okay, well, let's get into the people who don't speak English again on this show. But listen, at the end of the day, you know, you can always go to those people and say, listen, you know what? We know we need to tie. I'm a consultant. Your boss has hired me, right? We know you need to tie off. Let's figure out first why you're not tying off. Then let's figure out how it would make it easier for you to tie off. And then let's go from there, right? And then we'll build the procedures from there. So you're not tying off because you think that you can trip over the lifelines. Okay, that's one on that list. You're not tying off because you can't install the anchor on this roof because you're going to have to remove it anyway and yada, 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 right? Yeah, because I'm going to roofers.
Listen, that's challenges, two. John.
So now let's go back and say, how do we fix those? Right, you're not going to trip over the lifeline, but you can trip over the, you know, the cord on the nail gun, on the pneumatic nail gun. What's the difference?
But sometimes the answer is tell the boss to buy harnesses and lifelines.
Sure, and at that point, you go right back to the guy who hired you and say, "Hey,
this costs money."
That's fine.
Yeah.
At the end of it, if I was a consultant, I will tell you straight up right now. If I was a consultant and you hired me, and I said you needed to buy 50 harnesses for your 50 people that are exposed to heights, and you said, "Ah, that's a little too expensive," I'd be like, "Thank you for your business. Have a good day."
Yeah, but you have that
you're
luxury.
Not listening to that point. You're not going to listen.
No,
to any point.
And then you are. Look, if you're working for an organization that you have made recommendations to, and they have completely disregarded those recommendations, you are complicit in whatever happens next.
John, there's always challenges for safety professionals. A good safety professional is always looking for these challenges, is always attentive, is always in communication, and should always be finding and addressing and being part of the solution when it comes to safety on any workplace, whether it's a large-scale workplace, a large constructor, or a large organization, or the more challenging when it comes down to smaller corporations, smaller projects, bigger issues, or different variables that may come into play, right? So there's a lot of different challenges that safety professionals, and then the challenge is that people just don't want to listen to you, right? That becomes difficult too. And it comes down to your approach, and it comes down to whether or not you're relatable. But a lot of the information you provided today, John, it's you know, it makes sense. It's valuable. You know, we're always trying to do our best. We're always trying to learn different ways to how to address things. And you're right. We have WhatsApp chat groups and, you know, a lot of safety professionals that we bounce things off because we want to get the feedback. We want to get the different perspectives. And
that's,
you know,
important. It's important.
Me and John agree 85% of the time. But that 15% where we disagree, we flesh it out, man. Wow, how come this? And how about this reg? And how about this is applicable? And why would you apply it this way when you could? And it's not that we're arguing. It's just the way we pick each other's brain. And this is a habit of a lot of safety professionals.
It's healthy.
I think so.
Listen, it's healthy because at the end of the day, we're not going to be right all the time. We just finished talking about ego, right? And the, you know, the 15, 20, 25%, whatever it is that Phil and I don't agree in that WhatsApp group, which, you know, there are former ministry people in that group that have done fatalities and have clients and now work on the private side. So we'll bring it in that group and say, what do you guys think about this? And be able to kind of take different perspectives. And I think that we have the luxury of having that circle of friends that have been through what we've been through. But safety professionals and groups of safety professionals that get together, you know, whether it's committees or in different groups, you need this, right? Because you're not always going
to
agree.
Yeah, and you need to kind of push these issues too. You know, the last 5 years, a lot of people have been kind of, you know, just marching along to the song, you know, without asking questions or without questioning or critical thinking or a lot of these things, right? And I think it's now is extremely important, especially with everything that's happening in construction and different challenges that we're facing economically and risks that workers are taking and stuff like that. And I think now is the time for us to, you know, really pull up our socks and focus on some of these important issues and how we're going to address them, because we're being tossed more challenges. The entire Ontario health and safety system is getting tossed challenges that it hasn't seen in years. Right. So now it's really, you got to think outside the box, and we really got to push at
the work from home legislation. Now, if you're a remote worker working in your own house, sitting on your own chair in your own desk in your own room, and you get injured, the company can be held liable for that.
Yeah, it's your company.
If you're working remotely for somebody else.
There's a lot of scams going to happen with that one.
So again, and that's yet to be determined. Like the Sudbury case, we really won't see the impacts of that for quite some time until, you know, more kind of precedent gets set and cases come out to that effect. But at the end of the day, safety is changing every single day, but one thing remains the same, right? And that's why we do what we do, right? The intrinsic value of the worker's life.
All right, John, to wrap this one up, what do you think are the top three challenges facing Ontario's health and safety system right now? The whole system, the whole shebang bang.
Good question.
Enforcement in terms of the court itself, right? Everybody knows, Manny, you know I'm a big proponent of creative sentencing, and we're starting to kind of small steps see that in Ontario, but I think that the, you know, the punishments, Ontario has this habit of, oh, we've upped the fines, but there's never any precedent that ever got that high, right? So I think it's a scare tactic more than anything.
All right,
I think
fines and enforcement?
Fines and enforcement, but, you know, we could do a lot better with creative sentencing.
Sure. Any other challenges?
There's lots of challenges.
Come on, top three, John.
Right, I think that safety systems can be challenging for a bunch of different people. I think that because we do have a lot of international companies coming to do work in Ontario, specifically, you know, the tunneling companies that you know, own the TBMs and doing all that work. I think that kind of rigidity in terms of OHSMSs can be a challenge, right?
Sure.
So that's one.
Those are three.
Is that the three?
That's three.
All right. John, thanks for having, thanks for coming on.
I do want to just say one last thing. Sorry about the WhatsApp. I'm encouraging all the smaller businesses to start their own WhatsApp. Because 100%. The funny thing is that I've never been on a job site where I've experienced a team of constructors discussing safety. I've been on job sites where a team of constructors are discussing details of construction and how to build certain things and how they accomplish that. But they've never created their own WhatsApp group safety.
Manny, I'm in a few WhatsApp chat groups when it comes
to... But as business owners, small business owners, small low-rise...
What I'll say is this: if you are, if you don't have in-house safety, and even if you do have in-house safety, you know, it doesn't hurt hiring a consultant, right? Phil and I actually didn't work at the same time at the Ministry of Labor, right? So I've only known
first.
Phil left, came first and left first. But you can hire an S1. I've hired S1 for multiple companies in the past, so. You know, Phil does a great job, and especially because he's still down to the ground, right? He's not your big corporate consultant, but you can hire a consultant like S1, and Phil will do phenomenal work for you. But at the end of the day, you know, even if, look, if you're having financial troubles and you're like, I'm really not sure about this, right? And you can't hire a consultant for whatever reason, I have said in the past, just message me. If you send me a message and it's a critical question and I feel like somebody's life is dependent on me answering the question, just send me a message. I'll never charge you to tell you, you know, this needs a trench box or this should be sloped or you should tie off here. I will never ever charge you for that one simple question. But again, don't make that a habit, right? Call a consultant, call Phil, call, you know, S1, use the systems that, you know, Phil has and resources that Phil has
to build the
program.
All right, I appreciate it.
But that's John. The whole point of it, right?
It is, so it definitely is.
And that's where I was going with the WhatsApp
thing.
And
one thing's for sure, John, thank you for never charging me because I do ask you some questions every once in a while.
So you can start billing them now.
You can bill me, so I just send the bill. Thanks for charging me, Phil, for answering those questions.
Thanks for coming in, John.
Thank you very much, John. Oh, always a welcome knowledge. Thank you. I really appreciate it, man.
You're listening to Safety Corner, powered by TCL and S1, for workers by workers. Online and in-person health and safety programs and training available in 10-plus languages. Reach out to them at www.mys1.ca and DM them at my_S1 for more information.